On this episode of the Loopcast, I'm very excited to have three fantastic guests on the show today. We have David Gardenstein Ross, Dr. Tom Nichols, and Zach Beecham. And we're going to actually have, I'm sure, a rip-roaring discussion. Dr. Nichols wrote a fantastic article on his blog, The War Room, called The Death of Expertise, and it was posted on December 11th. And I'm going to let Dr. Nichols do a little recap of the contents of the article. But basically, just putting it all together really quickly, which, like I said, I'll let Tom give us a broader sense of what he wrote. But it's encapsulating the idea that there is a death of expertise, of course, as the title claims. But it's the idea that everyone nowadays is becoming an expert on everything with this new technological age of Twitter and Wikipedia and Google. So, Tom, why don't you give our listeners a little bit of a recap of what you wrote?
Sure. Thanks, Chelsea.
And welcome to the show, too.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here with everybody. I wrote the piece because as I said in the post, I don't think that actual expertise is dying. I mean, you're always going to have people who know more than other people about stuff. There's always going to be people who are experts in whether it's, you know, automotive repair, aerodynamics, or, you know, how big Russia is. There are always going to be those experts. What seems to have died is that anybody else in the world accepts that expertise. That every claim to expertise, if someone says, look, we're having a disagreement, but I'm an expert in this field, so let me give you my opinion because I think it ought to be the kind of controlling opinion until we know better. People would say, no, I read a few things. I read a book. I actually had a guy say to me at one point, well, I'm an expert too. I read a book a month. And I said, he said, that's how you become an expert, right? And I said, well, not at any school I went to, but okay, you know, if that's how you feel about it. And, you know, this is the age of Jenny McCarthy, the self-trained University of Google vaccine expert. And that's kind of run rampant. Now, it's always been this way to some extent. Americans are a very egalitarian people. They don't like somebody walking in the room and saying, look, I'm just smarter than you are. You may remember there was a great movie, Broadcast News, where Holly Hunter's character is a kind of a know-it-all producer, and her boss says, what's it like to always be the smartest person in the room? And she says, it's awful. And, you know, there is that kind of sense that no one likes a smarty pants walking in the room and saying, well, I know better than everybody else. But in the age of the internet, in the age of Twitter, it seems to have run completely out of control, where people who have done things for 10, 20, 30 years, someone who's just out of college says, well, that's just your opinion. Here's what I think. And that really stunned me. Maybe it is just kind of cranky middle age catching up with me, but I found that kind of amazing. And I'll just give you guys one story and then pass it on to everybody else. When I first started teaching at Dartmouth, there was a legendary story that went around about Robert Jastrow, the astrophysicist who visited Dartmouth. And he was talking about missile defense, and a young undergraduate kept disagreeing with him. And finally, after enough disagreement, the kid sat down and said, well, your guess is as good as mine. And Jastrow just looked at him squarely and said, no, no, no. My guesses are much, much better than yours. And to me, that kind of summed up the problem of expertise. A sophomore in college says to an astrophysicist, well, my guesses are as good as yours. No, they're not.
So guys,
that's what it was about.
So as I've thought about Tom's piece, which I think has a lot of interesting insights about particularly cranky people on Twitter.
And this is Zach speaking, by the way.
I sort of came to two realizations about how I thought about the problem and why my understanding of the situation was so different from Tom's and David's. The first one is that I think to a certain extent, expertise has never been in better shape, in the sense that while you can talk about Jenny McCarthy and someone like that popping up, there have always, as Tom mentioned, been people like that, and they were much more prevalent in the past. For example, in the 1800s, snake oil salesman wasn't an expression. There were literally people selling snake oil as a cure. And after standardization, regularization of professions, over the course of time, this has gotten better. That is to say, there have been more recognized authorities in the kinds of public available treatments and areas like auto repair or health that have led to broad-based improvements in healthcare, in, you know, the state of cars, other sorts of engineering questions, etc. But that, to me, is sort of less important than the second observation that I had, which is that to a certain extent, this is the same debate that we had at the outset of the blogosphere in 2000, 2001, when people said these are just people writing on the internet, who cares about what they think. And one of the things that sort of surprised me about Tom's essay is I thought that that argument had been definitively resolved in favor of the young upstart blogger people. In my world, at least, this is fairly clear. The best example of late, though there are many, 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 is a debate between Neil Ferguson and a variety of different economic writers on the internet. Ferguson is a recognized historical expert. He's written several very good books on particularly, you know, the history of the British Empire and the Rothschild banking system, an empire. I guess they're both empires. And then he wrote this piece last summer about the Obama administration, which got basically every major fact in the essay was incorrect, despite him being a tenured professor at Harvard. And this was pointed out by a variety of young, just out of college, internet commentators and other people like that. And they were correct. For example, Ferguson said the debt and deficit problem had gotten worse. It hadn't. He assigned job loss from January 2008 to the Obama administration's economic record. And so on. He misled his readers in a variety of fairly obvious ways, and he did so in ways that somebody who had a basic understanding of the issues could point out, and with an audience large enough, so someone who just started writing, say, The Atlantic or The Daily Beast or something like that could, well, the Ferguson published The Daily Beast, could easily point out Ferguson's errors and mistakes, and did so. And that was a tremendously effective corrective, because experts often hide behind the veneer of expertise. And this is what Ferguson did, by the way, after he was called out. He said multiple times, these are just people writing on the internet, who cares about what they think when I've written several books. That's almost a direct quote from his blog post. He's also, at various different points, said, look how many Twitter followers I have without tweeting. This shows that more people care about my opinion because I'm more famous and I'm more of an expert. And this wasn't...
Zach, David here, because this is a... This is kind of an example that's going on at some length. I mean, I think you actually went for the wrong example. I think a much better example would be Brown Moses versus Seymour Hersh, which is extraordinarily clear. I mean, the problem I have with the Neil Ferguson example is, number one, given the topic, which was involving the elections, a lot of the interpretation of fact was heavily determined by someone's political perspective. One of the things that you stated, I think, is just absolutely wrong. You said that the debt problem had not gotten worse under Obama, whereas it's indisputable that it has, right? That's why we keep having to raise the debt ceiling. I agree with you that the deficit has gone down, but clearly the debt has continued to rise. That's really just kind of an indisputable fact. But moving on from that, I just wanted to...
Go ahead. Be clear. His problem was misstating the CBO's long-term debt projection, which in fact has gotten substantially better. Like, you can read the CBO report. It's there in plain language, and it was pointed out repeated times. Ferguson even lopped off part of the CBO's quote that he used that said that led to the line coming to the opposite conclusion.
Honestly, I think this example is awfully dabbling in minutiae. I want to move beyond it, though. I disagree with a lot of it. I am not going to say that he got every fact right, but a lot of the claims that he got facts wrong were really awfully nitpicking in the sense that his writing lent itself to more than one interpretation. And so people picked the maximalist interpretation in order to knock it down. But again, this is actually a little bit beside the point. I want to address the first thing that you talked about, because I think that you make a good point, but I only agree with it to some extent. You make some objections as to the magnitude of the problem. In particular, you reference snake oil salesmen, which I think is a good example of how there always have been those who've exploited the ignorance of others to sell rather shoddy products. In particular, what Tom is talking about and writing about in his essay is not, you know, the young upstart bloggers who you hail, who I think have, you know, a mixed record. I wouldn't say that young upstart bloggers have been overall great for public discourse. They haven't been terrible for it. But I think you have perhaps an overly romanticized version of what young upstart blogging does. Just like any form of writing and any development, there are ways in which the ways that we communicate now can mislead. There are ways in which it can actually shed light. But in Twitter in particular, you're not having arguments that take place at blog length. you have arguments that take place at 140 character length. And I think there's a significant difference between the two of them in that this argument can come out the kind of length that you see on blogs. Whereas with 140 characters, much more often what you see is very shallow refutation where the shallowness won't necessarily come across over the course of the conversation. Sometimes it does, but if you're moderately smart, it's easy to make it seem as though you're not as shallow as you in fact are. And the second thing is that often you have well thought out arguments that are perhaps counterintuitive, simply answered with snark. And that, I think, is actually an inherent problem to the medium.
Can I just try and tie this together? Because I think I don't want to get into the minutiae of the Ferguson thing. I think Neil Ferguson is a kind of a low bar to clear, because if there's anybody who does appeal to authority and whose last line of defense is I'm a Harvard professor, well, there it is. I mean, I saw him one night on Mar. He was talking with Joe Queenan. Queenan said, well, I didn't go to Harvard. And Ferguson said something like, obviously. And I thought, well, that's not really an effective means of argumentation. And that's really not what I'm talking about. I think David's point about the upstart bloggers, I give those guys credit for at least putting their ideas on paper. What is amazing to me are the sheer number of people who, as we pointed out, 140 characters at a time, say things like, well, you don't really understand nuclear weapons, or you don't really understand the NSA. Or you don't really understand foreign policy. Let me give you a better – I like this notion of the veneer of expertise. Let me give you, instead of Ferguson, somebody who I think is guilty of this and is maybe the godfather of this going back to the 1970s, and that's Noam Chomsky, who has written extensively on politics, even though his background is in linguistics. He's a dilettante. His academic, quote-unquote academic work would flunk the basic tests of a graduate student paper, but because – ordinary people want experts deal in complexity, and the average layman, the average person engaging this stuff, hates complexity, and that's partly what's so frustrating about this. Experts deal in complexity. People like Noam Chomsky, people who are dilettantes, they reduce Howard Zinn. There's another bugaboo in the academic world. They reduce things to sheer simplicity itself. If you remember the scene in the movie Good Will Hunting, where the Matt Damon character, who's supposed to be just a working class schnook, and he kind of gives what for to the snotty Ivy League boys about, Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky and how history really is. That is the wet dream of every non-expert's conversation with an expert, to kind of body slam them with being better read and having read some secret stuff that they don't really understand. And I think that's the part that's out of control, is this craving for complexity that makes people argue with experts and reduce things to these simplistic nuh-uh kind of arguments, which, again, is the complete opposite of the way we're all taught to do these things.
So let me see if I can try to respond to what both of you said in one general diatribe. I think the Noam Chomsky example is excellent. It also illustrates what I was trying to get at with the broader historical perspective, which is, if Twitter has changed anything in particular, it's just that those random people who would hold their own views because of confirmation bias or whatever intrinsic human psychological tendency causes people to dismiss certain forms of expert judgment that disagree or contravene their expectations, disagree with them or contravene their expectations. That's always been there, and that's always attracted people to demagogues, to people posing as experts, and people using, in fact, the same sorts of appeal to authority tactics. One of Chomsky's favorites is, I speak a foreign language that you don't speak, and in this foreign language publication, it said fact X, which entirely and totally confirms the position that I have and that you can't possibly understand. Right? That's a nearly textbook sort of appeal to authority and a sort of appeal to his status as an expert
linguist. That's not quite right, Zach. An appeal to authority is someone who is way smarter than everybody said this and you cannot argue with it. It's not quite a hidden factoid. It's Chomsky's worst appeal to authority is that when you look into one of his footnotes, his footnote inevitably is to himself. That's an appeal to authority.
I agree. That's bad too. But to the broader point, there's a question of the direction of the problem right now, which is it a bigger concern that, one, Twitter is giving people who have sort of poorly informed or not well-informed opinions a broader opportunity to broadcast those opinions? Or two, is it that there is still a certain veneration attached to expert slash non-expert people who have on paper credentials, but ultimately make negative contributions to the public discourse. I think the latter problem is still bigger than the former. And so as long as that's the case, I have a lot of skepticism about anything that, you know, any purported or asserted death of authority, when in fact authority is omnipresent and in many ways a malign influence on public discourse.
Let's look at that concept, because I know that Tom, in his article, looks at the idea that some people might think of an expert as someone that's using the term expert to be elite. Or also, I remember you mentioned in your article, Tom, that the idea of using one's credentials to stifle the democratic dialogue, which is really interesting, because that can go both ways. Yes, there can be experts that might be doing that, depending on if they have deeper motives behind everything. But then on the other hand, there are experts that are just plainly seeing what they see as whatever the example might be, say, revolution of country. Their research is pointing to this going in a certain direction. So let's look at that idea of elitism. Is that really true?
As Zach points out, it goes the other way too, which is there's the kind of mob rule mentality, which is that 50 million Elvis fans can't be wrong.
Very true. Yes.
They can be wrong.
Yeah, I totally agree with that as well. I mean, Twitter is, like you said, there.
I had something.
Twitter leaves it open to everybody.
I said something critical of Yoko Ono once, and somebody said to me, well, she has, 400,000 followers. And I said, well, Kim Kardashian has 1.4, so maybe she ought to be in charge of global peace efforts.
So it's kind of this idea that if you have a lot of people behind you, they can't be wrong, which throughout history we've seen that there can be a lot of people behind dictators, crazy people even, that are wrong, and they do get it wrong, and they have horrible ideas. But this idea of the more people behind you gives you an expertise or gives you that power to be right, so to speak.
So, David here, I want to address this question. But first, I want to say something quickly about what Zach has set up, whether the kind of discourse that we get via Twitter is a bigger problem than expertism.
Yes.
And the area where I see this differently than him, I think that that's a fair question to ask, but it's a little bit beside the point, because we're not really dealing with a binary, right? It's not as though Twitter dispenses with the problem of expertism. In fact, we already talked about the way in which Twitter can enhance it. And when I say expertism, what I really mean is the kind of appeal to one's own authority that everyone on this podcast has expressed the rejection of. So I think that for me, when I look at and critique Twitter, what I'm talking about is not so much, oh, we would have been better off if we didn't have Twitter, get off my lawn, you kids. But rather, I think it's important to understand ways in which the new media in which we interact and discuss and debate influences the way that we communicate and the way that we think. And it certainly isn't all positive. I'm actually working on one of my projects, which I'm going to be rolling out in the Washington Post, I think next month, is an academic piece which really looks at the ways Twitter changes the way that we communicate. I'll say more about that later, but I do think that it's a very big question, and one that isn't a binary at all, because Twitter isn't going away, and nobody here is saying that it should. Now, in terms of the idea of expertise and elitism, I think that this actually is an important problem set. And I think that the younger a field, the more we should be very skeptical of expertism. So for more established field, area studies, one of Tom's areas of study is in both the Soviet Union / Russia. And area of studies is a very well-developed field. I work in a much younger field. I study violent non-state actors. And within this field, I find a lot of the current presumptions of the field held by people with academic qualifications that seem to qualify them as being indisputable experts are absolutely wrong. And so on a few different debates, you know, I've been on one side of the field where, you know, most people, or else sometimes virtually everyone else, is saying something very different. And, you know, I know that, Tom doesn't think that that's wrong. I mean, the arguments they make are both respectful, A, and B, you know, they get to the heart of the matter, and this is stuff that I have studied as well. So I think that, you know, the fact that someone is an expert, or even if they are a genuinely established expert, doesn't mean that they have all the right answers. But what Tom, and the area where I agreed with Tom, is that what his essay is really talking about is something much more basic, where someone does have the information that answers the question, and instead of giving some deference that, you know, someone who has been traveling back and forth to Russia for 30 years and studying it academically might know what life is like in Russia, instead there's constant demand for evidence, evidence, evidence. And I think that that is something which happens on the medium. But, you know, I actually agree somewhat with Zach. My final thought is that it's not, you know, this problem which is going to destroy discourse, but I think it is something that's happening discursively, and I think Tom is right to point it out.
And Tom, actually, in your article, you mention your experience, you know, in Russian studies and having gone to Russia, and you give a little bit of a story about how, you know, someone claims you're not an expert, yet you've spent all these years in high educational institutions and so forth, and that you kind of make a joke about, wow, all this money I spent and I'm not an expert, I should get a refund, you know. And I really liked that. That was really great. It was really, well, you know, it put your point in great perspective and also in a funny way, I must admit. So, I mean, if you'd like to recap that a little bit too for our listeners, because it was quite enjoyable to read.
Sure. And let me just pile on with David's point, because I actually agree with him more than he might think. I said, you know, very often I wrote pieces, John Schindler and I wrote some pieces together, and we said, well, you know, Russia, like the blind man and the elephant, Russia is like this. And people said, well, as David says, evidence, evidence, evidence. And we said, look, I can't go back and start from Russian Studies 101 with you. You know, you just got to take my word for it that at least some of this stuff is part of the foundational knowledge that most of the people in this field would have. And it's always kind of going back to an intellectual scratch, saying, well, you know, we're going to start at zero. And I said in the piece, boy, if I'd have known that, you know, all those years of learning Russian and reading all those books and going to the Soviet Union and talking to all those Russian people and going to all these Russian cities and doing all this stuff, I could have gotten around it cheaply by just talking to some guys on the internet who read a website somewhere. But look, on this issue of old and new fields, I'm very sensitive to this notion that experts can be really dumb, because I come out of a field that doesn't exist anymore because it was so wrong. I was trained as a Sovietologist by towering figures in the field, all of whom turned out to be completely wrong. And so I'm totally, but again, one of the things I say in the piece is, knowledge can be furthered and experts can be taken down and their research can be deconstructed and reconstructed, but it needs to be done by other peers, because you need to start with other people who come from at least the same foundation of knowledge that you do. I just got corrected on something I thought the other day. I was arguing with another Russian expert about Putin and the Olympics, and I changed my mind 180 degrees because someone who has a lot of knowledge about Russia made a very good point to me and kind of led me through some things that we both already knew, and I got to a different conclusion. I want to open one other before things go too late here. I want to point out something else that I didn't get to as deeply in the piece as I wanted to, but I think that all of us, that Zach and David and I, are all wrestling with, and that is the difference between normative and empirical arguments. People don't understand that difference anymore, that when an expert says something is, that's not the same as saying something ought to be. And people get mad about that. And they say, you know, if I say, for example, I said yesterday, I just read an article as a social scientist that showed there's no connection between gun laws and mass shootings. And people say, but there ought to be gun laws. Well, okay, that's a different argument than whether or not there is an empirical connection between guns and shootings. And people don't understand the difference between is and ought, and it makes me crazy in trying to have those discussions.
Right. I want to pick up on two things, both parts of what you were talking about there. First is really one line out of the first half of the last set of comments, which is the line about peers, that is to say the people who should be doing review of experts' work is other peers. It sort of begs the question to me as to what it means for somebody to be a peer. Do they need to get a certain sense of a set of credentials? I doubt that, because in the field that I probably know the best, which is economic philosophy, you can look at people who have become extraordinarily influential. Saul Kripke is the textbook example here. Influential and important and groundbreaking philosophers without even getting PhDs or going through the formal credentialing process. And some of them went straight away to academic jobs. In his case, he did. Because they've demonstrated an ability independent of the formal credentialing process to do top-notch work in the area. And that's the case, then what it suggests is we should judge people on, make someone into a peer, somebody worthy of evaluating these conversations on the basis of the demonstrated quality of their output, which means it could be anybody. It could be a random person on Twitter who turns out to just have an extraordinary depth of knowledge on a particular topic, and you can see by their, actual work as opposed to tweets that they've done that. Now, that's not a complete set of comments, just a thought that I had in reaction. Now, the second thing, this normative empirical bit, I think that gets to the background issue that we're talking about here, which is that people want to believe the things that they want to believe. And they're willing to go to extraordinary cognitive lengths to ensure that they believe those things. It's why I think there's some research suggesting this is true. I think some scholars at Dartmouth did it. It's quite good. That people's moral beliefs, their normative beliefs, tend to incline them towards a certain set of empirical beliefs that are essentially happy for that set of normative beliefs. So that's why you get in the gun debate that you referenced, people who believe there should be stricter gun laws will tend to say and believe that stricter gun laws work. And people who don't want stricter gun laws on both of these on basically moral grounds, guns are bad and dangerous and hurt people and you don't have a right to them versus I do have a right to them, will say that there's no evidence that gun laws work. As an aside, the academic consensus right now suggests that certain forms of gun restrictions are fairly effective, but that's, again, neither here nor there. The point is that the broader problem here is merely, and maybe Twitter is serving, and Twitter in all of the negative ways that we've argued, the graded negative ways. I like the way that David talked about it earlier, that they have, the medium has exposed the problem of confirmation bias and other forms of psychological biases more clearly than we had seen before in public discourse, and allows us to have a more honest confrontation with the ways in which people actually receive public commentary and expert knowledge.
Well, let me throw out another question here. And I mean, we all know that.
Chelsea, before we move on to a different subject, can we just think? I think Zach raised a really important point about, it becomes a closed circle. If peer review is the key, then who are the peers? And it becomes a kind of self-licking ice cream cone,
right,
or a back-scratching society. And I think that's a good point. But here's the key and this is where the expert argument intertwines with the generational argument. You know what it takes to become a peer? It takes time. And that is the thing that really enrages a lot of younger people who want to climb into these debates. Because, there's an old saying, it takes about 2 decades to get 20 years worth of experience. It is measured by output. It is measured by the quality of your writing that you put out in the public square and have other people make judgments about. It is done by people doing things like fact-checking you and by putting it out there, not necessarily boring academic journals, although those have their place, but even in the big marketplace of the internet where people can get out there and kind of hammer on it and chew on it. Today's my blog today, Bruce Blair, who's an arms control expert, weighed in. I wrote a story where I said I kind of doubted something he said. He came in and said, well, here's, we had a back and forth that really requires a certain amount of background in the issue of nuclear weapons. We are willing to be corrected, but we are not willing to simply be gainsaid by people who, as Zach points out, simply have a cognitive bias in the other direction and just find it inconvenient to have to talk to somebody who may know more than they do.
David, do you want to add to that?
I think that Tom has a lot of worthwhile things to say there. I mean, the question of what it takes to be an expert is an extraordinarily interesting one. Within my field, I have never actually referred to myself as an expert, in part because I think that expertise there is something that's a little bit more difficult to define, to be perfectly frank. But you know, so when I meet people like at conferences where I'm presenting, this has been happening to me for years. As we talked about just before we started this show, I don't have a PhD. I'm probably about 2 or 3 months away from defending my dissertation. But you know, for years when I've met people, they always say, "Oh, well, I assume that you had a PhD." And what that gets to is actually, I think, a fundamental point, which is about you know my field of study of violent non-state actors. That you know, having an academic credential, in my view, is almost irrelevant to expertism. You know, in 3 months when my PhD is conferred, that doesn't mean that I know more than I know now. And likewise, you know, when I'm on academic panels, my experience is often that the academic on the panel, the one with the PhD, is the one who knows the least about the subject. And again, part of that is due to the particularity, as Tom and I have agreed, that there's something different about a new field versus an established field. There are things that I certainly expect about PhDs. There are certain ways that having a PhD and going through research methods in particular makes you think. But when you're dealing with a new subject, a new body of knowledge, it doesn't necessarily give you all the tools that are necessary. So I think that, like, again, while I largely fall on Tom's side, I think that this question, particularly as we're in this fast-moving world where pace of technological and political change really is only going to increase, that raises this significant question about the basic definition. What does it mean to be an expert?
Wait a minute. Now we're definitely going to disagree because, you know, one of the other things we talked about before the show started was the infamous Elizabeth Obagi business where she put herself out there as an expert and dressed herself in credentials she didn't have. David has a point. In 2 months, it's not like there's going to be a magic transformation and he's going to get the key to the intellectual washroom that we seek and, you know, learn the secret handshake and then meet with us every year at the Meadows and all that stuff. Nonetheless,
sorry.
He will have from then on. And Colonel Sanders, his beady eyes. He will have a credential that carries the imprimatur of an institution we trust, and it will give us some reason to give him a second listen instead of being "I'm just some guy who says so." He will have the imprimatur of a major university that it isn't going to say that everything he says is right, but that will say, "Look, this is a person who knows how to conduct research in a responsible way." And that's the thing that credentialing actually gives you. You know, we had a part of the thing that broke into this Twitter fight the other day about expertise was the woman who I can't think of her name. She has a PhD in comp lit and she's become like an
NSA. Marcy Wheeler.
What's her name?
Marcy Wheeler.
And, you know, she's an expert. People say, well, she has a PhD. Well, so what? That's like having a PhD in mechanical engineering and becoming an art critic. It's the wrong form of expertise. And a PhD doesn't explain everything, but it does say, look, in a particular field, you have learned how to do the kind of research that's required. So I disagree with David quite strongly here that, you know, credentialing is, I understand that, you know, sometimes I hate this. The first time anybody ever tried it to me was a lobbyist in the Senate who was trying to muscle me on a bill.
Yeah.
And he didn't know who I was. He didn't know what my background was. And he said, well, you know, Tom, I disagree with him. He said, you know, Tom, I have a PhD in international relations. Of course. And of course I went, oh, well, in that case, God, you know, please straighten out my life. But there is something to credentialing. And I think that's the other thing that's gotten into this expertise debate is an irrational hostility toward credentials, largely because so many people don't have the patience or the time to go get them.
Let me quickly come back on this since much of that was a response to me. This David again. Quickly, number one, I'm not saying that there's no value to credentialing. I think actually that there is value to it. But as your example just illustrated, that value can be overstated. And that's where we get into the tension between you and Zach. I actually, like, to be honest, I don't think that you and Zach are at all diametrically opposed in this conversation. I think there's just a difference as to where the two of you place your weight. So, Tom, you place your weight more on your credentialing is important. It means something. I don't think Zach would dispute that it means something, but he would place weight much more on let's see the arguments.
I'm going to be
suspicious of credentialing. So, like, to give another kind of quick story from my own experience, the best analyst I know, hands down, of the Al-Qaeda network, no one on this podcast will ever have heard of because he works in government. He's early 30s, bachelor's degree from a small Midwestern college. And once in a while, it's someone who I think knows the Al-Qaeda network and many related things hands down better than anybody that I've talked to. And once in a while, he'll run into somebody who pulls the kind of, well, what are your credentials? And it'll inevitably be someone with a PhD. I mean, that's on the one side of it. That at the end of the day, I would go with my unnamed colleague on this one. And I think that pulling out the credentials is a way of getting around the argument. The flip side of it, again, is that per Tom, credentialing is not meaningless. It means something. But I think we get into this messy gray area where the question exists of what does it mean? And that's where, personally, what I would like to see is more of an interrogation, more of a discussion about what it means to be an expert in the environment where we're in circa 2013, 2014.
Right. Exactly. And let me moderate. Well, this isn't a change in my position. It's a way of explaining how I think about the questions that David just raised of what value does an expert credential play. And the best way for me to explain that would be how I use expert credentials as a shorthand when reporting things that academics have lots of useful things to say about. I have a topic that I know, some certain amount of things, but I need to know more and would very much like to know where the academic field that studies the question is about. I'll go and try to find a professor whose work is accessible in the sense that I can find it, not in the sense that it's jargon free. And I'll try to find somebody who's at a top institution in that field and read their arguments to get a sense of what the basic disagreements and positions are, if there's a consensus in the field, and if there isn't, what the main fault lines are, what this particular person is, how I can cite them reasonably and fairly, right? And what the credential serves there is a shorthand for somebody who is likely to have access to a series of important knowledges about the topic that I'm attempting to learn about. And I will, and I think that is a very useful function. In terms of, we're talking just public discourse, not any other role that academics play in terms of informing public discourse, because that's really what this conversation, the sort of scope discussion of this conversation is.
Let me see if I can create some unity out of diversity here, because I take David's point about the AQ expert, and Zach, I totally understand your point about, the experts can give you a kind of temperature read, but sometimes they're not the best guide to actually finding something out. Here's the way I look at it. The AQ expert that David's talking about, the Russian studies field, the Soviet studies field was full of those guys in the 1980s, guys who knew chapter and verse. They were, they were at the kind of master's degree level, or they were working in government. They'd never gone on for more graduate school. And if you ask them a very specific, narrow question about that field of, how many missiles, what's the Russian military doing today? These guys knew more than anybody. The problem is that they were an inch wide and a mile deep. And the whole point of expertise, in my view, is to be able to take that and to make it a more integrative process. When I first got to Georgetown, I didn't get to Georgetown until my third year of grad school. I traversed through Harvard and Columbia first. And the first thing they did was take me aside and say, no more Soviet stuff for you. No more guns and bombs. No more military stuff. You're going to read Plato. And I was appalled. I said, "This, what a colossal fat-assed waste of time it's going to be for me to have to sit here and study, intro to political philosophy with a Jesuit." And
then you found out later on it made you a Jeopardy champion.
Well, yes. No, actually, going to a good, a decent public high school made me a Jeopardy champion, but that's a whole other. At the end of it, I realized that what expertise is really about is the ability to make broad analytical connections using a particular body of knowledge. Because what you get with the, for instance, that AQ guy is the same thing that will happen with the Soviet guys after the 80s. That's a very specific knowledge. It has a short shelf life. It's a lot of knowing. It's a lot of being a knower, but it's not a deeply analytical approach that can go outside of, you know, for example, to do comparative kind of work. And I think that's really, really important. Now, to Zach's point, yeah. though, credentialing is not, Zach, let me just say, I agree. Credentials are not everything, but they are something. And they are, it's not that I think people should at least respect them. I think people should at least not be hostile to them, which seems to be the new norm.
Well, let me throw a monkey wrench in here. David, I mean, do you want to – I see that you want to say something. Go for it.
Oh, I just wanted to quickly say that Tom's archetype for the AQ guy I'm talking about does actually not apply in this case. I understand where he gets it from, and since we're talking about someone that he doesn't know. But in this particular case, I would say it quite clearly doesn't apply. It's I'm talking about an analyst who actually has a remarkable ability – to compare, you know, current situations we face to a broad array of past political conflicts. But in terms of this particular archetype, someone who knows a particular subject, I think his will often apply. But I would caution that it's not a universal application of the inch deep, mile wide. Or
yeah, fair enough. But as a rule, I think that that is more often true than not. But I
agree with you entirely. It's more often true than not. It isn't always, though.
Well, right. There's some clear research about what makes somebody a good expert in terms of social sciences and predicting particular and developing active policy relevant predictions about particular things that end up being right. Are you all familiar with Philip Tetlock's work on this stuff?
Yes, but I reject the idea that prediction is what we're about. Explanation is what we're about.
Well, yes and no to a certain extent, right? Like, yes, explanation is like a key part of the academic mission. But when we're talking about public discourse, a lot of what people do when they write is they say X trend, we can explain X trend and extrapolate from said explanation that Y is going to happen, Y is bad or good, and hence Z policy option.
Look, at least in policy studies, it's a probabilistic science, and one of the, you know, you can see where this gets abused by quote unquote expertise is when you look at somebody like Bruce Bueno de Mesquita, who claims to have an algorithm that predicts things. He's a well-known professor, and I think it's nonsense.
No one's allowed to see it, which is
and no one's allowed to see it. Exactly, it's a special magic algorithm that only the experts can look at, wearing special goggles. And you know, it's utter nonsense. And I agree, that's expertise run rampant. But prediction, my problem with prediction is, you know, life is strange and contingent and unusual. And when I predict things, and I, of course I do, I mean, I get out there and say, I think this will happen, I think that won't happen. But I think we experts are the ones, especially, who understand the value of saying, I think that X is likely to happen, given the circumstances. It's like meteorologists, right? When they say it's an 80% chance of rain, they don't mean it's going to rain in 80% of the city. They say 8 out of 10 times these conditions produce rain. And I think social scientists have a value in saying, look, 9 out of 10 times, 8 out of 10 times, it looks like this, but it doesn't always, and I'm open to other explanations. That's different from the non-expert who says, I want it to be this way, and I don't care what any data says, and I'm not listening anymore, la, 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 and they stick their fingers in their ears.
Except in Tetlock's research, the non-experts were as good in terms of guessing what they think a likely outcome was to be and that likely outcome to correspond with reality as the experts. And an algorithm, in a lot of cases, was better than both of them. Now, we can say whatever we want about Bruce Bueno de Mesquita's research, but it would suggest that something –
we all agree there.
Yeah, I think we do. But it suggests to me that and also the other thing that was – sorry, I need to say this before I get to my conclusion, which is that the people who were least confident to a certain degree, not just, you know, baseline less confident, but more willing to listen to other perspectives, to bring in lots of different forms of knowledge to bear – foxes in his archetype rather than hedgehogs who know one big thing, from Isaiah Berlin's essay on the topic, right? The foxes had a much better predictive track record than the hedgehogs in terms of most individualized things. And what that suggests to me is that people who are more open to non-expert criticism or criticism from other people in general are more likely to get at the truth of situations. And that is That's the place, the motivation behind my skepticism of the valorization of expertise. But it's a respect for the opinions of other people.
Zach, you're mixing two things, because in some areas, or look, we're in danger of being in heated agreement, because one of my favorite books is The Wisdom of Crowds by Sorwetsky, you know, where kind of big numbers of people are better at predicting the stock market than any one given stock market analyst. It can happen. But when you're talking about something as intricate as public policy, where you're not talking about aggregating market outcomes, for example, like, you know, what movie is going to be a big hit as opposed to what movie is going to be a flop. Sometimes, you know, polling the crowd is going to be a better indicator than any one studio executive. That may be true, but that's a different world than policy expertise. And I think that mixing those two things is dangerous. Now, with that said, remember, I come from a field, Soviet studies, where almost every major figure that was an expert turned out to have engaged in a massive pooch screw by 1991. I mean, I was taught as a young academic that it was literally impossible for the Soviet Union to fall. And so I am deeply, deeply skeptical of people who claim expertise for its own sake, just as both of you are. On the other hand, I say in the blog post, the expert is not always right, but he's more likely to be right than you, than the non-expert. And you're saying that's not always true. And I'm saying within something as complicated as policy, rather than, you know, stock picks or, you know, movie openings, then I think that's more likely to be true. But we don't disagree that the one thing that an expert should never do is shut off any further input from any other direction. I think but that doesn't mean that everybody gets an input. I say in the piece, there's a difference between peer review and everybody review.
See, I feel like the key word for me in what Zach said before you spoke, Tom, was that for me, the key word was the word guessing. And basically, like we were saying, peer review, he was saying that the majority of people who guessed got it right, which there's nothing wrong with that. If they do, more power to them. But I see what Tom is saying in the sense of experts don't necessarily guess. They back it up with research, evidence, and then come to a conclusion and make a prediction, if we want to call it a prediction or, you know, a good guess. But the whole idea of just guessing and getting it right, if you do, that's great. Fantastic. You know, good for you.
My guesses are that Robert Jastrow's the quote I started this whole thing with, Robert Jastrow saying, my guesses are much, much better than yours. They can still be wrong.
Right.
But on balance, my guesses are going to be better than yours when it comes to Russia or nuclear weapons or the intelligence community or foreign policy or whatever it is. I mean, we can both be wrong. But on balance, if your life depended on it, you know, it's not a coin toss. You're probably going to ask an expert before you ask a non-expert. And that was, to me, that's a very fundamental thing. That's all I was trying to say in the piece. And it has produced, you know, mountains of outrage.
So let me throw another monkey wrench in the conversation.
I want to say one thing about something Tom said specifically, which is the distinction between public policy and other topics.
Right.
And it's a very narrow point, which is that Tetlock's research was about public policy. It was about public policy predictions and economics predictions. And it found that people who were experts in the field did know better, or sometimes worse, than random people in the study on predicting a discrete set of developments. It's like a study that took place over, I think, about 10 years or something like that, or maybe more, compiled thousands of guesses. And what it suggests is that if we're talking in the narrow band of prediction, not, you know, factual information, which is a different, as Tom's essay said, factual information is a very different kettle of fish, but in terms about predictions, experts here, and Tetlock's study is not the only one that does this. It's just the most well-known and the most interesting. Experts appear to have no better of a track record than ordinary
Zach,
people.
You're still ducking something important, which is that you're talking about economics, which is the aggregated decisions of many human beings. And I'm talking about what do we do about negotiating an arms treaty, for example, with one other country that requires an intimate knowledge of their leadership. You know, for years, it's been remarkable to me that people say, oh, Putin, let me tell you about Putin. And I just sort of sit there and say, no, go ahead, please explain Russia to me. And that, I think, is different. You know, that's a different kind of almost arrogance or empty-headedness than the people saying, look, I think the market is going to go this way. My dad had no formal education. He didn't finish high school. He was an expert at playing the market because he, like you, he said, look at the big movements. Don't, you know, don't look at, he didn't, he had no guru. He didn't follow Jim Cramer or anybody like that. And sure, that's a different kind of, you know, popular wisdom. Like I said, the wisdom of crowds. But when you get into very specific policy questions that are not the aggregated decisions of millions of people, you really do need somebody who's doing more than just kind of going with their gut.
But that's exactly the kind of question that this research studied, right? And it said, it suggested that experts' predictions were no better than others. And I don't want to sound like a broken record, but it seems to me that if there's a prediction problem in social sciences more broadly, and again, this is a range of social science questions, not just expertise, but also major political events and things, exactly the sort of thing that you just talked about, and experts are having no better success at predicting the future, I think that that is, it's not research whose findings I like. Like, I would much prefer, given my own views, to be able to be like, look, if I call an expert and this expert tells me one thing and I can put that in my piece, that I can think that's an epistemically valid way.
You know why you're wrong, Zach? Because I have a PhD.
Okay, so let me butt in here because I've been listening to you guys for a little while. This is David again. I find predictions to be relevant. I actually find them to be quite relevant to evaluating someone's expertise, but let me caption that in a second. But first, I want to address Zach's point a little bit, because policy expertise is such a very, very broad thing, right? It's not like there's anybody I look at and say, "Oh, that guy is a policy expert," right? I mean, that's like, you know, so incredibly broad as to be meaningless. I think that there are certain areas of policy which will yield better predictions, and certain areas of policy that will yield worse predictions. And I think that when you actually start to disaggregate it a bit and look at where experts' predictions tend to be far more right than the crowd, and areas where they tend to be either no better than the crowd or worse than the crowd, then we'll learn a lot more about those specific fields and what's wrong with expertise within those fields. But at the level of broadness at which you expressed it, those findings are almost meaningless to me. Now, to get to where I find predictions to be relevant, I find that when experts diverge from what Tom put forward as an expert paradigm, that's where I hold the wrong predictions most against them. So Tom's paradigm for expert judgment is that I'm not rejecting alternatives. I understand that different possible futures can exist, but I'm going to express probabilistically the way things are likely to turn out. I think that is an entirely legitimate way of going about things. And I think the more someone is able to build in contingencies and possible branches into their analysis, the less I will hold it against them if they get their prediction wrong. The thing that I find most problematic is when people present their predictions as though they are ironclad, as though anybody who disagrees must be a moron, and yes, then they get them wrong. I'm actually working on a piece about this right now, which is predictions about the Arab Spring, and why did the field tend to get them wrong. But I think that one should absolutely pay attention to an expert's prediction, in my view, even though I agree with Tom that experts are more necessary for explanation than prediction. Despite that, I do think that paying attention to predictions is important, because to me, it serves as one gauge as to how well their views over time are mapping with what actually does occur.
Well, let me throw a monkey wrench into this conversation. So we keep on hearing the terms right and wrong as regarding predictions or ideas on a policy topic, et cetera, et cetera. So let's just look at this idea as, does it really matter to be right or wrong? I mean, in academic discussions, debates, whatever you want to call them, a lot of great ideas come from the debate of, as we were talking about earlier, you know, one person says an expert or a professor, whoever, got it wrong, and a debate might take off out of that and other ideas might blossom from that. So let's look at this idea of, does it really matter to be right or wrong? I mean, of course, I'm sure certain instances, yes, I would say personally, but let me hear your side of it.
Let's try to be precise in answering the question. I think that there's, like, useful failure is a useful concept. Somebody getting something wrong and them learning from that failure, and people more broadly learning from that failure, be it a predictions failure or an interesting argument that ends up being factually incorrect or has some logical stumbles in it but raises profound and interesting questions, it's worthwhile. That's one way in which wrongness can inform. When it comes to making the topic we've been talking about recently, public policy predictions, or predictions about world events, I think that there's a bad way to be wrong, which is that if you say, because of my prediction, you should do policy X, and then the government does policy X and it's disastrous, that is unquestionably bad wrongness. But if you predict something and it turns out to be wrong, and that tells us something interesting about the world, that your prediction was wrong, that maybe its assumptions were bad, then that's a useful way of being wrong about predictions. I think my favorite example here, and there are many that you can choose, is John Mearsheimer's prediction in the early 90s that after the fall of the Soviet Union, Europe would turn into a nightmarish Hobbesian hellhole when Germany equipped itself with nuclear weapons and the security dilemma from the 19th century returned. Now, he was obviously, at least for the next past 20 years and what appears to be the foreseeable future, wrong about that. And the reasons are that the assumptions that he brought to bear on the question, the assumptions of offensive realism in general, are questionable at best. And I think that was exposed very handily by Mearsheimer's overconfident, broad, strong predictions. And we learned, I think that there, as someone that pays attention and has a graduate degree in international relations, I think I learned a lot from reading that paper and judging it in light of the history that's happened afterwards.
I'm glad you brought up Mearsheimer, because that's to me, that whole, that whole University of Chicago approach of kind of overbearing arrogance on international relations is exactly when people get kind of fed up with experts. I mean, I think it's really important that if you're wrong, you can somehow accept that you're wrong and cycle that into your next round of research. And one of the things that strikes me about people like Mearsheimer, and especially about his next generation mentoree, Bob Pape, they're never wrong. And I think that's they're just never wrong. I mean, if history turns out differently, it's because history screwed up, but the theory is still valid. And I think that's when people kind of raise their eyebrows and say, maybe the claim to expertise is just a way of kind of the Jedi mind trick of, these aren't the droids you're looking for. And I didn't actually make a mistake. With that said, I do think that the notion that the way an argument is structured can be enlightening in and of itself. And I think one of the things, to go back to this point about normative versus empirical arguments, one of the problems that non-experts have is they don't know how to separate those two things when they're making an argument. And they jump. But one of the things I find very frustrating about Twitter or about public speeches or about classroom interaction or whatever it is when people keep jumping the rails back and forth between them. Between is and ought, and what I want and what is. And I think that's an incredibly frustrating thing that, again, experts are trained not to do it. I think one of the things we have to think about here is methods rather than actual knowledge. Because in the rejection of expertise, and I say this in the piece, if you reject expertise as a concept, you are rejecting the way we gain knowledge and the way we've gained knowledge for 1,000 years as a civilization. And that doesn't mean, as I said earlier, I disagree with you, Zach, and I know I'm right because I have a PhD. Well, okay, that's no one should argue that way. On the other hand, being an expert doesn't therefore make you wrong unless you can actually keep predicting the future, which is kind of where we've gotten to with this debate. And I think it's frustrating because it's almost like we've marketized or commoditized expertise like a brand. And I think it's unfortunate because I think it's making us dumber by the minute.
I feel like, Thomas, that you brought up a very interesting argument in the sense of when you talked about the University of Chicago. And there's that whole concept that you talked about earlier of being attached to a well-named institution for your degree, whether it's a master's degree or a doctorate, gives you that credential, which, I highly believe as well. I mean, certain institutions are known for their great research, great knowledge. So, I mean, I'm not saying that's not the case. But personally, I found during one of my degrees in Cambridge that even though it was open to discussion, debate, the institution itself and the professors really wanted to drive in their views into your head. And I don't know, it might just because it's a very old school institution, But there is a little bit of this concept of, yes, you have a new idea. However, this is how it is, and this is how it has been. And they really kind of wanted to mold you into what the institution produced for hundreds of years. So this idea of institutions giving you the credentials, but as you were saying with the University of Chicago, some institutions do have a tendency to lean one way. I mean, how do you see that? Let's discuss that a little bit.
I think David and I would probably, this is probably very dear to our hearts, because intertwined with this whole experts question is the dysfunction of the modern university.
Right.
And the fact of the matter that for all of my defense of the peer system and the peer review system, the fact of the matter is the peer review system is broken, and it's been broken for a long time, and it has serious problems, and it's going to require each intellectual community. I think David's point, especially about each area of expertise, has to kind of police itself and decide when it's going off the rails or not, has to fix that peer review system. And it is true that some universities clone themselves. They produce students. I mean, you know, again, the University of Chicago is a great example. I mean, they literally clone their PhDs over and over and over again. And in a very, you can always spot that kind of research, mm-hmm. challenge the conventional wisdom, back up and, you know, make sure that the research matches that conclusion and so on and so forth. Nonetheless, I also think that, as I said earlier, a university puts an imprimatur on you as knowing not a particular field of expertise, but knowing how to keep gaining knowledge in that field of expertise rather than being a one-time learner or having that inch deep, mile wide problem. But there's no doubt that the modern university system, the tenure system, the way young faculty are trained and raised and treated and abused, I would say, is clearly dysfunctional. And that's a problem with advanced degrees.
Well, guys, we've had a very heated debate here. We've been talking for over an hour, so I think we should kind of wrap it up. But why don't I do this? I'll open the floor to each one of you to make a final comment, final statement on everything that we've talked about. So who would like to go first? How about Zach? Zach, would you like to go? No one's standing up to the podium here, so...
Sure. That was an uncharacteristic from the three of us silence.
Yeah, I know. It was just dead silence all of a sudden.
No one recognizes modesty when they see it.
I think it's that all of us want to go last, to be honest.
Yeah.
Well, I went first at the outset, so I'll wait.
Wait, no. First and last are an advantage, as David and I both well know.
Well, next time you write the article, Beauchamp.
That was a joke for probably like three people who are going to listen to this.
Okay, calm down, guys. Calm down.
Go ahead. Yeah. I think I want to pick up something that you said, Chelsea, which was interesting, which is about how you teach students. I think it sort of encapsulates the way that I think about the generation and the replication of knowledge, which is that as an undergrad in my philosophy courses at Brown, it wasn't that my professors taught to me by lecturing at me and expecting me to recognize the wisdom of the arguments that they were making. It's that they would present an argument and then would tell the students to challenge the argument. And then I have never been so profoundly defeated routinely in verbal conversations in my life. And it was the experience of seeing that somebody has such a depth of knowledge and such analytic reasoning powers that you need to learn and understand where they're coming from before you are really going to successfully be able to engage them in a peer type argument. And that learning happened, that iterative learning happened over the course of, you know, my good courses as an undergrad, the ones that worked well. And that model that experts demonstrate routinely their facility with knowledge and the fact that that credential means something, and they do that through their work, through their teaching, their writing, their public appearances, that to me is the proper role of experting in societies. You develop people who really are experts and can show it to the rest of us and can do so in a way that productively and helpfully informs public debate, which is what we're talking about here. Now, lots of people, I think the bigger problem is that our current system, for whatever reason, produces people who have on paper what look like expert qualifications, and it presents as pseudo-expert knowledge when it's written to somebody who hasn't spent time in the field. But now, with broader information technologies giving more people access to public debate and ability to contribute to it, you're getting more challenging of these pseudo-experts who are, I think, much more of a problem than the other things. And that, to me, is, well, while there are costs, and I think David is right to talk about this on a graded scale, I think that this information technologies and the spread of questioning, if it exists, which I'm not sure about if it's any worse than it is now, but I do think that having public debate where anyone with a podium can challenge people who claim to be experts has been, on balance, clearly a good thing.
Well, let me let David back clean up, in fairness. And I'll end on a personal note instead of recapitulating what I wrote in the article. Look, I come from a background where experts were both friends and enemies. I grew up working class, not poor, but kind of on the edge of poor. parents had no formal education. Most people in my neighborhood had not been to college. Mm-hmm. That classic American story. And to us, a lot of times experts were people, I lived out in the western part of Massachusetts, and experts were heads from Boston who came out and told us that, you know, we were undertaxed and we weren't virtuous enough and, you know, all that kind of liberal 70s good government nonsense that I grew up in. And so I totally understand people who say, look, experts are just people who live on a mountaintop and tell you how to live your life, and they're kind of jerks, and I get that. On the other hand, as I, you know, you kind of grow up and you get past that, and you realize that there is a role for experts. They are not gods, but they are, you know, they have their role to play. And the reason I wrote this post to begin with is not because I think experts are not getting enough love and deference, but because I want people to stop hating on them simply out of some misguided egalitarian nonsense that has more to do with the egos of non-experts than with the actual predictions or track record of real experts. And I think that's the thing that most disturbed me, and that's why I wrote the piece.
So to offer concluding thoughts, I think we are at a point where there are many fields of knowledge that are new, you know, not necessarily entirely new, but where things have changed significantly. I'm working in one, and there are many others where, due to technological and political developments, the field looks very little like it did in, you know, the 1980s or even perhaps the 1990s. And despite their newness, they're important. So one of the areas where I would disagree with Zach throughout this discussion is his emphasis on the current system, as he said in his closing system, being problematic in its production of knowledge, without disaggregating the different fields of knowledge within the current system. I agree with him for many fields. I think that there are problems in terms of production of knowledge in various discrete places, but also they aren't always true. In Tom's original blog entry, which I'm sure you'll link to next to the podcast, he gives an example of needing your carburetor fixed and going in and arguing with the mechanic because you've read articles about a carburetor and you think you know what needs to be done better than the mechanic does. Almost everybody looking at that would see that as an example where the person arguing is being ridiculous and the mechanic is, in fact, an expert. As I expected with respect to this overall discussion, it was a very rich discussion, which is why I first recommended, after seeing this lively Twitter debate between Tom and Zach, that we do a podcast. But also, as I suspected at first, there actually isn't as much difference as it seemed on its face. I mean, there certainly are areas of clash. But to me, the difference between Tom and Zach is an area of emphasis. Do you think some of the ways that we communicate and some of the, I'd say, pathologies that derive from those means of communication, the Twitter problem that I raised earlier, do you think that is more of a problem, or do you think what we all call expertism, that is someone saying, trust me, I have a Harvard PhD or a PhD from University of Chicago, is that more of a problem? And you know, Zach and Tom place their emphases a little bit different, but overall, in terms of the broad contours of what we're talking about, I think there actually is much more agreement than disagreement. I'm very suspicious and reject what we call expertism. At the same time, I think that nobody would dispute that there are certain means, there's certain ways of communicating and challenging knowledge that one could associate with new social media that are themselves unhealthy. And this is one of those you know, difficult areas of discourse and production of knowledge that's going to be very important to navigate in the coming decades.
Well, I want to thank all of you for coming on the show. And as David mentioned, we will be posting a link to Tom's article, The Death of Expertise. Please check out his blog as well, called The War Room Blog. And it's been a joy to mediate this fantastic discussion debate. And please, listeners, read Tom's post and get into the debate yourself. Well, thank you, Tom, David, and Zach, for coming on the show. And very happy holidays and a new year to you.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah, you all too.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. And hopefully we'll have another heated debate again very soon.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you.